Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's May 1st, 2014 7th Annual Conference, Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin chaired this 12-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 11. Mark Fitterman, David Sirignano, and Mary Dunbar will discuss important trading and investment practices and market structure developments affecting hedge funds. Now, on to the podcast.
I'm going to begin by discussing some developments that we anticipate happening shortly in the area of Section 13D beneficial ownership reporting, as well as some related issues that are getting some attention dealing with possible insider trading issues that involve in connection with the filing of Schedules 13D and announcements of possible control transactions. Just the basic rules to start with. Section 13D of the Securities Exchange Act requires anybody who crosses 5% beneficial ownership report within 10 calendar days that ownership, either on a Schedule 13D or if you qualify a short form 13G, and certain institutions get even a break from that 10-day requirement. But for the activist shareholder, anybody who's certainly intending some kind of control transaction, the basic rule is within 10 days of crossing 5%, you have to file a Schedule 13D disclosing your intent with respect to the securities, your holdings, and a lot of other detailed information. During that 10 days, there's no prohibition on acquiring additional securities well above the 5%. In the past, it was not unusual for a raider type investor to file that 13th D on the last day and report a position as high as 20-25%. More recently, mainly because of some changes to Section 16 reporting rules that require essentially someone to report within 2 days after crossing 10%, that's somewhat governed by that rule, and you don't see as drastic initial reports anymore. But again, during that 10 days, you can continue to acquire. There's no cooling off period. And that's quite a long period of time. There's also some concern arising in some recent reports in the press that have raised this, that there's no limitation on who you can tell about your plans to file a 13D, to announce a transaction or other activist program. And there is some concern that these filers are favoring certain other investors with news of that, so they could acquire, essentially warehouse the securities to further the transaction. And the question is, well, is that insider trading? How can those people buy non-public information that certainly is material? I guess there's really two questions. One, how can someone continue to buy after they cross 5% knowing that they plan to engage in a material transaction? Isn't that insider trading? Is not material non-public information? And two, how can they tip others as to their plans and let them trade? Isn't that illegal tipping or some other form of insider trading? The Dodd-Frank Act affected 13D reporting in two potential ways, none of which have come to fruition yet. One is it empowered the commission to define when equity-based swaps equate to beneficial ownership of the underlying security, so as to trigger beneficial ownership reporting. When is a synthetic position the same as a cash position for reporting purposes? This arose out of the CSX decision where that issue was litigated. The SEC actually filed a letter with the court saying that it does not believe swaps give rise to beneficial ownership without the more being some way to control the voting or disposition of the counterparty's position in the security. Dodd-Frank, which came after that decision, empowered the commission to address that more specifically. Just a reminder, even though the SEC hasn't acted on that rulemaking yet, other than to preserve the status quo, equity-based swaps can have reporting implications. For example, if you're in the Section 16 reporting regime, because you're a 10% insider or because you're on the board of a company, trading in swaps is a derivative security with respect to the underlying equity, and you need to report that, and it's potentially matchable for the short swing profit provisions of 16B. Also, if you are filing on a Schedule 13D because of your cash position, you're otherwise over 5%, then you have to report your positions in swaps or your intention to engage in swap trading because it's an arrangement respecting underlying security. So there is some regulation there. Secondly, Dodd-Frank gave the commission authority to address the 10-day problem, mainly contemplating that the commission would shorten the period on the theory that, you know, this is 2014, 10 days is forever. No one needs 10 days to prepare a disclosure document anymore and get it filed with the SEC. Shortly after that provision was enacted, the Wachtell-Lipton firm filed a petition for rulemaking with the SEC, urging it to act quickly on that, but they haven't. There is some word, we're starting to hear members of the staff saying that this issue is coming to the top of their rulemaking agenda. It didn't have a deadline on it like much of the other Dodd-Frank and Jobs Act rulemaking, so they kind of got pushed back, but they say now it's going to be addressed, and certainly all the publicity this issue is getting will accelerate that. So the commission could address this in a number of ways. It could certainly shorten the period. My guess is it's not so much the amount of time people have to file a report, but what they can do before they file a report. So I would expect the commission to look at some kind of standstill or cooling off period where it creates an incentive to get the report in as fast as possible because the filer could not acquire additional securities during that period. It also may want to put some kind of prohibition on this notion of tipping. First, let me answer the question I asked before. Why is not insider trading for the acquirer to trade on its own information? Well, the way the Supreme Court has interpreted Section 10B and Rule 10b-5 under it is actually need some kind of breach of duty in addition to trading on material non-public information to violate the anti-fraud provisions and engage in illegal insider trading. When you're trading on your own information, it's your idea, you identify the target, you know what kind of transaction may be beneficial. That's your information, and the general notion is you're entitled to trade on that. There may be an economic justification for that. Law and economics person might say, well, that's their reward for coming up with the idea, spending the capital, taking the risk, so they should be able to engage in a large acquisition program at a low cost before public disclosure, as an incentive to benefit all investors, I guess except the ones that sold to them, but by bringing control traction to the front. But what about tipping others, a so-called wolf pack type scenario where one investor tips others as to that person's intention? Well, again, there's no breach of duty because that person freely gave the information to these others without putting any restraint on their use of that information, any requirement that they keep it confidential, but they did not ask them not to trade. They kind of blessed the trading because that's why they gave them the information. That's a much more problematic scenario. The SEC actually addressed that issue in the pure tender offer context under Rule 14E3 back in the late 80s. It actually adopted a rule that says it's illegal for someone who gets information from the bidder or for a bidder to tip someone who is likely to engage in trading. The difference is it was adopted under a rule that's specific to a statutory provision that's specific to tender offers, Section 14E of the Exchange Act. That rule gives the commission authority to adopt prophylactic rules to prevent fraudulent practices. The pure Section 10b-5 area doesn't have that, and the Supreme Court has consistently interpreted the commission's rulemaking in that area to be limited to actual fraud. They can only prohibit actual fraud. But we'll see what the commission does and how they address this. They could try to do something like Regulation FD, essentially say as a disclosure requirement, you have to file your 13D at the sooner of 10 days, the first day you tell somebody else about it or some other type of event. So if you want to tell other people about it, fine, but you got to put your 13D on file that day. I just want to take a minute to emphasize the substance of the prohibitions of 105 because there's still a lot of confusion out there. All of us were trained under the old rule that said you couldn't cover your shorts that you put on before the offering during the restricted period with your allocation. So it was a can't cover rule. In about 2006, 2007, the commission changed that and said you can't get an allocation if you engage in short selling during the restricted period. So the focus is much different now, and the prohibition is against getting an allocation, not what you do with it. As many of you are aware, last summer, the SEC adopted Rule 506C, which eliminated the prohibition on general solicitation in Reg D offerings, and Reg 506D, which implied a bad actor disqualification to 506 offerings. And that was all pursuant to the Jobs Act. the same time, the commission also put out proposals to adopt new requirements, particularly with respect to the Form D filing, but also with respect to offering materials, particularly general solicitation offering materials. Those proposals have gotten a lot of adverse comment. They are properly referred to as somewhat draconian. Some say that the politics of it was the cost of getting 506C adopted to get additional votes on the commission. They had to put this out. And it's likely that what will be actually adopted, if anything, will look much different than the proposals because the political leverage will change at that stage. It has some pretty draconian requirements, including doing a Form D filing 15 days in advance of doing any general solicitation. If you use any written general solicitation materials, you have to submit them to the SEC no later than the date of first use. A whole bunch of different additional disclosure requirements in the Form D itself that private entities are not used to making public. Additional disclaimers and disclosures that go into the offering materials. And that's the flavor of it. It's going to have a real impact on the private funds who are in somewhat of a continuous offering mode. A lot of traps for the unwary. Just as an example, the requirement that you file 15 days before you engage in a general solicitation and that you file any written general solicitation material keys off the concept of general solicitation, which is a very vague concept. It could be a very private transaction, but if you don't have any pre-existing relationship to the person you're talking to, existing SEC interpretations, that's a general solicitation. And so you could slide a term sheet to someone who haven't done business with before, that's written offering material. You just violated two rules. You didn't file with the SEC and you didn't file a Form D 13 days earlier. So on top of that, there's a draconian disqualification provision. Unlike all the other bad actor disqualifications currently in the SEC's rules, the one they propose has no requirement for adjudication. If you fail to meet the Form D filing requirement, you're disqualified with respect to any future Reg D offerings for 12 months. That's before anybody catches you and finds that you violated the filing requirement. And so you have a Section 5 violation on top of everything because you engage in further Reg D offerings when you were disqualified, may not even known it. I will stop there.
Mary and I wanted to talk a little bit about the fact that market structure has resumed its place on the front pages of a newspaper as a result of the publication of Flash Boys, the new book by Michael Lewis. And there's a certain element of deja vu here, or the more things change, the more they remain the same. The commission started down the market structure road in the early to mid 1970s at a time when the New York Stock Exchange was 85 to 90% of the order flow. There were regional stock exchanges. There were no alternative trading systems. And the commission tried to do things that would increase the competitiveness of regional stock exchanges, eliminate fragmentation. And so the SEC adopted the consolidated tape. They adopted the consolidated quotation rule. They adopted a vendor display rule. They adopted a plan rule to create a vehicle for filing of national market system plans and to do all these things to try to reduce fragmentation and improve competitiveness of the other markets. Fast forward to the mid-2000s, you have two major developments that affected the market. One was the adoption of Regulation NMS, which, in addition to renumbering all the rules that I just mentioned, adopted a trade-through rule, basically requiring people not to trade through protected quotations, and if they did, they had to send what are called ISOs to take out better price quotations in other markets. Also, the commission forced markets to go to penny stock increments. In the day, you used to have 8-point increments, 16-point increments. Now you have penny increments. The result of those two things was creation of really what's an electronic market. And the result of that is significant increase in volume, a significant increase in the number of exchanges, a significant increase in the number of alternative trading systems, both lit and dark. That's a result of those factors, plus other factors, which one is payment for order flow, one is what's called maker-taker rules on the exchanges, which reward people for either placing orders or taking orders, or penalize them for doing that. Co-location, which the Michael Lewis book discusses at great length, which is the idea of putting your computer close to the computers of the market centers, the development of algorithmic trading, and the growth of what's called high-frequency trading. And so we're going to talk about some of these issues. We don't have any answers as to what the SEC is going to do next. Chair White testified earlier this week before the House Financial Services Committee, and she said that she didn't think the market was rigged, but she's on top of the issue and the staff is thoroughly analyzing it. So we're going to have to wait and see what they do or not do. Someone asked me earlier if the commission was going to eliminate Reg NMS. I think it's a little hard for them to do that given where the markets are now, but we'll see. Mary?
So we have up on our slide the basic SEC definition of what they consider to be high-frequency trading. I think, as you know, they put out a concept release in 2010 asking for the public to comment about the current equity market structure, and Chair White noted that they had gotten over 400 comments in response to that, but very little data. So one of the things the SEC has been focused on, according to the commissioners, is gathering more data in order to do what she is calling a data-driven analysis of how they should move forward in this area. And as Mark noted, one of the key things that they're looking at are co-location and the individual proprietary market data feeds that the exchanges are putting out vis-a-vis what's coming out through the consolidated tape. And as Mark and I were talking about it, it raises a kind of an age-old issue about exchanges. And are there certain market participants who have a time and place advantage? And I think, Mark, if you want to talk a little bit about it, that's not a new idea. It's an old idea.
I mean, time and place advantage has really always been there. Prior to the elimination of fixed commission rates, there was the ability for people to buy a seat on the nearest stock exchange and go down and trade for your own account. And the commission staff always worried about the time and place advantage that you had about being on the nearest stock exchange in a day when it took a while to get an order down to the floor. Specialists were another group who had time and place advantages. So now you're dealing with high-frequency traders who arguably are said to have some type of time and place advantage by virtue of the fact that they can get from one market to another faster than everybody else.
And I think even today, there was just an SEC settled action that just came out. We frankly haven't had a lot of time to look at it, but it does touch on a couple of these issues. It involved the New York Stock Exchanges and their adherence to their own rules and to the Exchange Act. And a couple of the provisions of the settlement order are of interest on this topic. One of them concerned co-location and how the exchange was offering that service. And the order states that co-location was offered for a number of years before the exchange put it into a rule proposal and started charging all of the participants the same prices. And it also talked about a certain proprietary data feed that was made available to floor brokers at an earlier time in the afternoon and how that was not consistent with one of the rules in place. So I think these are ongoing issues that the exchanges and the SEC are wrestling with. The other thing that they're looking at is how is the pricing working for exchanges and how are they bringing order flow in and how does that affect everyone? And we have a slide up here about the exchange's maker-taker model that I think Mark was going to talk about.
The question is, what are you doing to attract order flow? And some exchanges provide rebates to people who place resting limit orders and charge people who take those orders. The question is that skewing the markets in terms of where the order flow is? And the maker-taker model has been subject to some criticism. The markets that use those models strongly defend them. So again, it's one of those issues that really has to be dealt with by the commission as part of the overall structure. I think it's hard for them to look at maker-taker payment for order flow in a vacuum. I think they have to think about what is the fairest way to have a market without destroying liquidity, because the argument is that high-frequency traders provide liquidity to the market, particularly since the stock exchanges have eliminated the historical specialist system, eliminated affirmative obligations on market makers, and so market makers don't play the same role in terms of providing liquidity that they used to.
And even the new owner of the New York Stock Exchange, although some of the exchanges are using MakerTaker, he's very publicly saying, I'd like to do away with it. So it's a very interesting debate that's going on. So in addition to the policy debate, there are ongoing investigations, a number of which frankly seem to have gotten revealed after the publication of the Flash Boys book, so that they all want to say they're looking into the issue. The one who was out in front of the rest was the New York Attorney General, which isn't unusual, that they are sometimes out ahead of the federal regulators, and he has been somewhat outspoken in saying that he thinks there's federal gridlock and that he has concerns that he's referred to some of these practices as predatory, that he's referred to there being a new generation of market manipulators, and has announced that he has ongoing probes of the stock exchanges and some of the high-frequency trading firms and dark pools. He made these announcements in mid-March ahead of the publication of the book and noted that he had been working on these issues since last fall when he had reached agreements with some of the newswire organizations about limiting their early dissemination of certain news to organizations who had requested that. So after the publication of the book, the FBI said that they had a high-frequency trading initiative. The U.S. Attorney General said that they were looking at whether high-frequency trading violates insider trading laws. Interestingly, this week, Mary Jo White, in talking about the SEC budget, in addition to saying the market is not rigged, said she thought there was confusion on this point as to whether this conduct could constitute insider trading. Now, the New York Attorney General is calling his initiative Insider Trading 2.0. So apparently there's some difference of opinion among the regulators right now in how they're looking at this, and it's evolving. And in addition to these investigations, there was also a class action brought by the City of Providence against the exchanges, the high-frequency trading firms, and a number of the large broker-dealers that operate dark pools, very similar to the allegations in the Lewis book, alleging 10B fraud, that the exchanges violated Section 6B of the Exchange Act, which is their main regulating provision, and also that it constituted insider trading under Section 20A. So there's a lot of activity on that front. FINRA is also part of what's going on. They started targeted exams last year of high-frequency trading firms and alternative trading systems, and they are about to implement a new rule that will require the ATSs to report to them aggregate weekly volume on a delayed basis, but they will also, on a delayed basis, make this information available on their website. So there's a lot going on in terms of exams, investigations, talk about new policy initiatives, and that includes the various SEC pilots that are under consideration, at least by virtue of the press, nothing official yet. So one of them would be MakerTaker elimination, and you know, with the head of one stock exchange saying he's in favor of that, that one might get some play. The Jobs Act has a tick size. The SEC was required to look at whether a wider tick size would benefit small or medium-sized companies, and the press reports are saying that the staff is potentially considering kind of a layered pilot where they would look at different things, where they would test a nickel spread, a penny spread, and then maybe a nickel spread that would also include a trade at rule, which is what some of the exchanges have been advocating, saying that order flow should be sent to a public exchange unless it can be offered a meaningful price improvement. So those are some of the things, as well as disclosing the execution venue to investors. That's another item that's under consideration as we understand it.
I think some institutional investors and some markets have advocated that broker-dealers be more transparent about how they deliver order flow and what they do with order flow. So we have a lot of moving parts. We'll see where this heads, and maybe we'll have some answers same time next year, so stay tuned. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
To listen to other panels from the 2014 7th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit PodcastCentral at morganlewis.com. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius, LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefundsresources.